This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Matt Katz, sitting in for Brooke Gladstone. Now we turn our attention to an older war in Europe and the journalists who saw it coming. They are the subject of a new book by historian Deborah Cohn called Last Call at the Hotel Imperial, The Reporters Who Took On a World at War. In it, Cohn follows a tight-knit band of American journalists who started their careers in the 1920s, four friends who became famous foreign correspondents and supplied news to millions of Americans. They often gathered in Vienna.
You walk into that bar, you want to get in on the conversation, tough luck. You better have some really good information about the latest palace intrigue in Romania or a really good gossip about Stalin to retail. They are shouting, they're interrupting each other, they're making fun.
There's John Gunther from Chicago, a fixture of the American bestseller list from the mid-1930s through the 1950s.
Gunther is big, affable, the kind of man whom everyone likes to talk to. As a friend of his says, you put your head right down on the pillow of his personality and start talking.
Cohn says that Gunther was the peacekeeper of the group, but if he was butting heads with anyone, it was probably H.R. Knickerbocker.
H.R. Knickerbocker is really a live wire of a man. People are arguing with him.
Nick worked for Hearst and the Philadelphia Public Ledger. He won the Pulitzer Prize in 31 for a series on Stalin's first five-year plan. And with him hitting the booze was the charismatic Vincent James Sheehan, who also went by Jimmy.
Everyone is always falling in love with Sheehan, both men and women. And as he says, he can stand it until he's got three or four women who are proposing marriage to him.
Jimmy Sheehan's political memoir was the inspiration for Alfred Hitchcock's 1940 film, Foreign Correspondent.
I don't want any more economists, sages, or oracles bombinating over our cables. I want a reporter, somebody who doesn't know the difference between an ism and a kangaroo. A good, honest crime reporter. That's what the Globe needs. That's what Europe needs. There's a crime hatching on that bedeviled continent.
Also in the middle of the gang was the Dorothy Thompson. At one point, her syndicated columns reached around 8 to 10 million people a week.
She is a central figure in the reporters' bars, trading jokes, getting those big interviews. She interviews everyone from Freud to Trotsky to Hitler.
Thompson was the first woman to head up a major American overseas news bureau and the first American correspondent to be kicked out of Hitler's Germany. She got her own movie, too. Katharine Hepburn plays a character based on Thompson opposite Spencer Tracy in the 1942 film Woman of the Year.
A lot of drink in these.
Oh, I don't know.
Well, I'm just made of you. Not used to them, you know.
Oh, don't worry about me. As a diplomat's daughter, I've had to match drinks with a lot of people. From remittance men to international spies. And I may say I've never wound up under the table.
Gunther, Knickerbocker, Sheehan, Thompson were, for the most part, not frontline war reporters. Their job, as they saw it, was to root out the biggest stories of the post-World War I world. And the most pressing, they each ultimately realized, was the rise of the dictator.
They're on the scene, and what they're trying to figure out is what modern dictatorship actually is. It's a new phenomenon. It's something that people haven't seen. So if the world has centuries of experiences with kings and emperors, who are these people who claim that their authority descends from the people, but they disdain hereditary rule, and they have, you know, these massive rallies? And a lot of smart people at the time think that dictatorship is a passing fancy, that either Hitler and Mussolini and the Austrian dictator Dollfuss, either these people are going to sort of settle down and act like normal leaders, or maybe they're going to actually destroy each other. So Hitler and Mussolini seemed like the likely candidates because they're so jealous of each other, each infringing on the other one's prerogatives. And so it seems really well into the late 30s that maybe there's not going to be a dictatorship versus democracy contest, but maybe it's going to be a dictatorship versus dictatorship contest.
So John Gunther, he's from Chicago. He interviewed Trotsky. He interviewed Churchill. His early coverage of the rise of the dictator is a really important part of the story.
Absolutely. John Gunther has a sense that the big story in Europe is not going to be the enshrinement of democracy, which is what people think after the Paris Peace Conference, right? You have all of these new democracies that have been created from the rump of the disbanded empires. Instead, he begins to think, as he says to a girl he's trying to impress in 1926, I think the big story is actually not democracy, but dictatorship. And he has a sense that comes from having been a city reporter in Chicago about these outsized personalities and the kind of influence that they're beginning to wield. And that really becomes the story that makes his name.
You write that the reporters who gathered at the Hotel Imperial in Vienna, the status of their interview subjects functioned as a proxy for their own status. The bigger the name they landed for the interview, the better for them. What were some of their biggest gets?
Newspapers were hungry for stories about these rulers. H.R. Knickerbocker interviews Mussolini 4 times. He also interviews Hitler. Dorothy Thompson interviews Hitler. And John Gunther interviews FDR, Churchill, and Trotsky. The interviews with dictators, of course, they make brilliant copy. What you find out if you try to interview Hitler, though, is that he essentially treats every reporter who comes to see him as he treats his stadium audiences. He just launches into his stadium address and just keeps on talking. And when you try to interrupt him, he won't allow you to do that. And he just has scripted remarks. Mussolini is different. Mussolini doesn't permit anything that he says to be quoted verbatim without actually looking at it. So there's very little that you can publish that's really interesting out of these interviews.
Sometimes these reporters got their subjects really wrong. Dorothy Thompson, you write, conducted a hard-won interview with Hitler, only to basically downplay his evil. "I saw Hitler!" exclamation point was the headline. She wrote, quote, "He is the very prototype of the little man. And if Hitler comes into power, he will smite only the weakest of his enemies."
You know, they're praising dictatorship at a moment of its formation. And so a lot of the things that we now know, which is dictators aren't going to go away on their own, or as they say in the interwar period, dictators don't usually die in bed. They need to be killed. That's how they're going to leave power. Either that or the utter annihilation and destruction of their countries. Knickerbocker or Gunther, who do take Hitler more seriously in the early 30s, are ridiculed for being an alarmist. Dorothy Thompson is, you know, very much in the main line when she thinks this guy's a joker. You know, what is he going to amount to? Like many people, she thinks, you know, what does this Austrian house painter have that would actually make him a persuasive leader of the German nation? So what she gets wrong is that she doesn't see the ways in which he is speaking to the deeply injured parts of the German people and their experiences of defeat, demoralization, and so forth after the First World War. And later on, of course, her friends tease her mercilessly about having gotten this wrong. And as she says, it's okay to be wrong the first time as long as you get it right the second. And Dorothy Thompson really spends the rest of the 1930s as one of the most lucid and forceful advocates for American intervention in the European war.
Can you give a couple of examples of when these reporters raised the alarm about the possibility of World War II?
You know, they were really talking about World War II from the mid-30s. And there was a kind of joke at the time, which was, when would the war break out? Were you an end of 1936-er or were you an early 1937-er? You know, by 1934, it was really clear to them that the dictatorships were probably not going to destroy each other, that there was a three-cornered contest that was on between fascism, democracy, and communism. And how that was all going to shake out, of course, they didn't know. But they made a set of quite startlingly accurate predictions. So in 1937, Knickerbocker, for instance, predicted the Nazi-Soviet pact when, much to the surprise of the world, Stalin and Hitler ended up on the same side. Knickerbocker also predicted, right at the start of the Second World War, he said, this war is going to last 6 years. He pretty much predicted how the war was going to go. So part of what made them really good reporters was that they did have some uncanny powers of perception.
And then the other interesting conversation that's happening then that is also in so many ways happening now is over objectivity. Critic Jay Rosen calls it the view from nowhere. But you write this argument in journalism was indeed going on then during this rise of fascism. Knickerbocker and Gunther rejected the, quote, both sides approach to reporting in their coverage of Nazism early on. That was criticized, right?
Absolutely. So John Gunther's editors in 1933, right after the Nazi takeover, he was sending these reports about Jews being beaten up, about actions by anti-fascists who were spray painting the walls with anti-Nazi symbols, about the brown houses where enemies of the regime were being tortured. And his editors at the Chicago Daily News, which is a liberal paper, write back to him and say, please send us more diversified copy. We can't just have articles about Nazi atrocities in the paper all the time. What happens after the Second World War is the re-enshrinement of the value of objectivity and a much more detached kind of realist sort of view of foreign affairs.
Tell me about the way in which you decided to write this history. You describe your source material as, quote, thousands and thousands of candy-hued slips of paper bound together with rusty paper clips or stuffed into envelopes. On one scrap, a confession of infidelity. On another, a rumor about Stalin's family life. You don't separate the reporters' private lives from their professional ones in telling these stories because they themselves didn't really draw a clear line either. As a reporter myself who talks to his therapist about work, I found it pretty cool that these guys did the exact same thing. They were getting into psychoanalysis. Why was it important to dive deep into the personal worlds of these reporters in order to understand their journalism?
They are almost metabolizing these successive crises, right? The 1930s are just one crisis after another. The invasion of Abyssinia, the annexation of Austria, the Munich Agreement, and the Spanish Civil War. They're taking in these crises the way that they fundamentally shape their inner life. They shape their relationships, they shape their marriages, they shape the ways in which they raise their children or feel that children should be raised. In other words, the boundaries between inner life and geopolitics just absolutely collapsed. And so journalists are asking themselves, what is the relationship between a marriage and an empire? How are kind of personal pathologies being worked out in geopolitical terms? Those are the kinds of questions that really propel them and motivate them. And they were drawn into stories, and in a sense, they got stuck inside them.
You wrote that in the late 30s, Jimmy Sheehan has a breakdown of some kind. He felt as if he'd become a sort of human lightning rod or seismograph for the universe's political ills, that he could predict them.
So, you know, all reporters depend upon a good set of hunches. You have to be in the right place at the right time, and you're only there if you actually are perspicacious about what's going to happen next. Someone like Sheehan feels that he can almost feel the kind of hands of the universe, the hands of geopolitics on him. He also has a premonition that Gandhi will be assassinated by a Hindu nationalist. And he goes to see Gandhi, and he is right there in the courtyard as the assassin fires the gun. And then, of course, is completely devastated and feels responsible. Like, why couldn't he have stopped it since he knew that it was going to happen?
In the face of authoritarianism, journalism is stretched to its limits. The Hotel Imperial Club of Reporters warned of World War II long before it happened. Sheehan liked the experience to seeing an avalanche travel down a mountain, trying to pull people out of the way, only to be largely ignored. How did they all reckon with the limits of their journalistic power?
You know, this too is not unlike our moment in the sense that we have a set of observers who have long been warning, whether they've been warning about the kleptocrats or they've been warning about Russian expansionism and revanchism. For the reporters in my book, they are both witnesses, but they also are participants, right? What they want to do is to raise the alarm among their fellow citizens, to tell them what is coming. And that is ultimately a very frustrating enterprise, because as much as they do raise people's awareness about the European continent and actually troubles in Asia as well, they can't achieve what they want, which is for the US to intervene in the Second World War. And that, of course, you know, doesn't happen for almost 2 years. And they're extraordinarily frustrated.
Dorothy Thompson wrote in 1939, "Do you feel as I do, a sense of sickness, as though all the world and everybody in it and you and I were sick in our nerves and in our brains and in our hearts?" I imagine that line resonates with some listeners today. There have been plenty of comparisons made between this moment we're in now and the 1930s in terms of threats to democracy, ascension of fascism. You spent years researching and writing this history. Which parts of it are you returning to now? Are you thinking about when you're reading the news, when you're looking at more bloodshed in Europe, more bloodshed in Europe than at any time since this period you wrote about?
It's devastating. I mean, so first I think about the extraordinarily brave journalists, both people who have stayed to report anonymously now inside the Russian Federation, those extraordinarily brave journalists, both Ukrainian and foreign correspondents who are on the front lines and in extraordinary peril now. I think about that and I'm incredibly grateful to them because this is the way that we're going to know something of what happens. I think that the style of the 1930s was a high emotional style, and that's our moment as well. And at the same time, for those people who are most exposed, and journalists really foremost among them, you realize the extraordinary toll that this work takes on people. It's not just the problem of being a bystander, but it's the ways in which the project of authoritarianism is fundamentally to reach into every aspect of private life and to affect it.
Well, we appreciate you telling these stories. They're compelling and so resonant. Thank you very much for coming on the show.
Thanks so much for having me. It's been really a pleasure.
Deborah Cohn is author of Last Call at the Hotel Imperial, The Reporters Who Took on a World at War. She is also the Richard W. Leopold Professor of History at Northwestern University.
Я люблю свою страну, люблю свою жену, люблю свою собаку.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Micah Loewinger, Eloise Blondio, Rebecca Clark Callender, and Max Balton, with help from Aki Camargo. Zandra Ellen writes our newsletter. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Adrian Lilly and Andrew Nerviano. Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. Brooke Gladstone will be back next week. I'm Matt Katz.